Bernie Sanders has been there his entire career to help promote the interests of the public. He's against fracking. Hillary Clinton is not. Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, leaned toward approving the XL pipeline. And the corruption issues. We know that her brother received hundreds of thousands of dollars to get a pardon for a couple of his clients. You know, this whole Clinton dynasty dynamic is so anathema to most people, and certainly among independents. And by the way, independents are going to control the outcome of this election. And they don't trust Hillary Clinton. Her unfavorability ratings are horrible among them. Bernie Sanders is the only candidate running for president right now that has a positive net favorability rating. That's just amazing to me that people don't realize this. And when you say we want somebody who can beat Trump, the only person, according to the polls, that has a good lead over Trump in poll after poll after poll is Bernie Sanders. And Hillary Clinton could easily lose this race, especially given the trajectory that we're seeing in terms of people's lack of trust for her. And it's on so many issues.
I'd like
she
to
was
ask,
at Wall Street. Pocketing $400,000.
Rocky Anderson, if I could just interrupt for a second, because we only have about a minute left. I wanted to ask Dolores Huerta. Dolores, you've been associated with the Democratic Socialists of America. Bernie Sanders is a Democratic Socialist. Your response to the fact that an independent and an avowed socialist is running for president and racking up so many votes, but you're supporting his opponent?
Well, first I want to respond to the issue that the gentleman just mentioned. I want to say this. I think when you assign to Hillary Clinton what her brother did, that is so sexist. And it's so typical of that, always to blame women for something that somebody else did. You know, women have to clean up the mess the way Obama had to clean up George Bush's mess.
I just want to point that out. For Bill Clinton to grant a pardon to his clients. This is, you know, it's like Chelsea
Clinton.
She gets
I want to stick by what I said.
Oh, unfortunately, we have 10 seconds to go, Dolores.
Again, I think Bernie has a strong message. I think that Hillary can make it happen. When it comes to being able to have affordable college for students, I think Hillary can make it happen. To improve the Affordable Care Act, Hillary can make it happen. That is the big difference between the two candidates.
And we'll have to leave it there. I thank you both for being with us. Dolores Huerta, civil rights activist, co-founder of the United Farm Workers of America, and former Salt Lake City Mayor Rocky Anderson. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is now 8:02. Coming up next, Talk Radio with our host, Paul Roland, and his guest, Karen Coulter. Your calls will be welcomed in about 5 minutes at 503-231-8187. But first, these announcements.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the film screening of Firefighters, Architects, Engineers, Expose 9/11 Myths on Saturday, April 2nd, at the Portland State University Lincoln Performance Center in Portland. The film will be introduced by Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. There will also be a Q&A session after the film. Again, that's a screening of the film, Firefighters, Architects, Engineers, Expose 9/11 Myths with Richard Gage, Saturday, April 2nd, at the Portland State University Lincoln Performance Center, 1620 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, accessories, and gifts with a focus on U.S. made and certified fair trade natural fiber clothing since 1984. Gazelle is located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at GazelleNaturalFiberClothing.com.
Thank you. freedom, you can't tell that which slavery is too well, for its very name has grown to an echo of your own. It is to work and have such pay as just needs life from day to day, in your limbs as in a cell, for the tyrants used to dwell, and to be for him made, loom and plow and sword and spade, with or without your own will bent to their defense and nourishment.
And good morning. This is once again Wednesday Talk Radio. My name is Paul Rowland, and we just heard Brenna Sahatchian, who will be appearing along with Cinderwell and Mistaken for Ghosts at the Velo Cult, which is up on Northeast 42nd Avenue in the Hollywood District, this Friday at 7 p.m. as a benefit for the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project, whose animating spirit and longtime organizer thereof is a guest in our studio this morning, Karen Coulter. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning. Good to be here.
And Karen has dedicated herself for over two decades to protecting native forest ecosystems on the east side of the Cascade Mountains with Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project. And I've known her for longer than that. We were active in Earth First and a number of other projects together. We've crossed paths numerous times over the years, and so I'm so glad to have her on to talk about many different things. As we all know, more or less, some of the worst fears and predictions of environmentalists and earth scientists seem to be coming to pass with global climate destabilization. It's the cumulative impact of all cumulative impacts, as it were. Forests, like all other ecozones or biotic communities, are being impacted by climatic changes, as well as by the same old invasive industrial practices that got us into this darn predicament to begin with, which Karen and many others have been fighting to stop for all these years with mixed success. As we persevere in our efforts to slow down and ground this infernal machine, as well as understand what we're actually facing, it can be good to remember the direct, unmediated encounters with the natural, that is, not fully humanized world, that have nurtured our sense of at-homeness with the earth and with the cosmos, even in the city, although with added difficulties. We're talking about sudden and intriguing encounters with other animals, with synchronistic occurrences, mystical intuitions, that kind of thing. So we'll be talking about all this, as well as current threats to the East Side Forest and this upcoming benefit concert, which you can find on Facebook and elsewhere. And that's what we'll be doing for the next 50 minutes, and your calls are welcome at 503-231-8187. So Karen, I'm so glad when we talked on the phone and you really got into the spirit of this, because obviously you spent, you know, you resonate with this because obviously it rings true to you, but you've also spent so much time out in a natural environment, which inevitably leads to the kind of experiences, encounters that I'm talking about, but probably even goes back to your young days, like with most of us. I think, I don't know. I just feel like there's this sort of this natural, it's like a strange attractors, you know, in physics, is kind of this natural attraction that just happens, you know, when we don't completely cementify and canalize and technologize everything. Things just happen, and you know, it is such a dire thing, and it's just so overwhelming a lot of times. I think I just don't talk enough about, you know, the good stuff. It's like what really gives us strength, you know, what really makes us realize how important the kind of work that you and so many others do. So yeah, let's get into that. I mean, there's time in the hour to talk about all the fights with the bureaucracies that you keep on engaging in, and everything else. But yeah, just what did that bring up for you when we initially talked about that?
It brought up a lot. Far too often we just talk about the destruction and what we're doing to try to stop it, but we need to recognize what we're losing as well, which is a very intimate connection with nature, with real life. Virtual life is human life, is computer life, etc. But real life is what sustains all life on this planet. And when you mentioned, surely we've had experiences with this since a young age, that's totally true. For instance, I had a raccoon when I was growing up, and she bonded with me. So she would try to protect me from a dog. When she was inside the big cage and I was roughhousing with a big dog, she would raise her hackles and start snarling. When I was with her, she'd sit on my shoulder and play with my glasses and snap my wristband of my watch. And so that was a unique experience. Another one was that I was hiking in Nevada as a young person, and a coyote just drifted in right in front of me and just led me on this hike. I just followed him. He was only about 6 feet, he or she was only about 6 feet in front of me, and I just walked after this coyote, and the coyote would look back at me and kind of grin and just keep going. And I've had lots and lots of experiences like that. Another one was where I was with my dad fishing in the ocean off the coast of California, and we'd go fishing in the winter and bring up all these fish to eat, but looking at them, there was this incredible diversity of colors, techniques for protection, size, everything. And I was just fascinated by this entire underwater world that we never look at, that we're never down there to experience. And he had a very deep love for the ocean. So I acquired this deep love too, which is why I know how some people, including indigenous people, can feel a deep connection to an animal even when they kill and eat it, because we were feeling this deep connection. We were using the animal, but we were also feeling the connection. And since then, I've had many more experiences like that. Like, for instance, one time I was in Glacier National Park, and I saw a mountain goat stretched out on top of this big rock formation. I was wondering if it was injured or something, because as I kept trying to get closer to take its photograph, it didn't move and just stared at me. Finally, I climbed up a chimney in the rock, a crack in the rock. I was too smart to put my head up over the edge because they have horns, but I stayed about 2 feet under the edge of the rock and just waited. And sure enough, the mountain goat came over and looked down the crack at me and walked around to directly where I was and put its eye sideways, its head sideways over the crack. So I was staring into the eye of a mountain goat at only 2 feet away, and it had this incredible serenity and self-confidence and assurity in its eye. And I realized when it left, why? In part because it went up this steep scree slope that would have taken me at least 20 minutes and around 20 seconds. But it was really curious about me, and really the strength I got from its eye was incredible, from looking in its eye.
That reminds me of a story that Paul Watson tells about the whale, mm-hmm. the looking in the eye of a whale.
Oh, that'd be neat.
Out in the middle of the ocean. It's a really extraordinary story, which I wouldn't do justice to. And, you know, we all of us who've spent time, been lucky or privileged enough to be able to spend a fair amount of time out in the mm-hmm. natural world, you know, all have stories to tell. I've heard so many amazing stories. My brother's a botanist up in Alaska, up in Fairbanks. He spends a lot of time out in Denali National Park, and just most amazing stories he has to tell. But even small stories, as I said, even in the city. And, you know, I did want to kind of acknowledge, you know, that it is, in a way, it's strangely and really tragically, in the modern world, it is a sort of a privilege and a fortune to be able to have, you know, these kind of experiences, because so many people are living in an urban environment that isn't as amenable. But even in an urban environment, you know, if we're open ourselves up, pay attention, these kind of experiences can happen as well. And I encourage, I don't know, the term synchronicity is such a a key concept for me, you know, both, you know, at an abstract philosophical level and at a very direct, you know, gut experiential level. But it's still very controversial. And I think it really gets at what we're really talking about today. The idea of like just things just happening versus forcing things on nature. I think that's like just so absolutely crucial.
Yeah, let me talk about that a little bit, both the city aspect and the synchronicity. In the city aspect, I've been spending my winters in Portland for about the last 5 years. And recently I was in the backyard where I live in a shack behind a communal house. And it's a very nice backyard. It's planted primarily with native plants, shrubs. It has lots of trees. It's very diverse. And I suddenly saw a hummingbird. And it came right in front of my face and hovered for a conspicuously long time, long enough for me to really identify it. And I saw that it was not a rufous hummingbird. It was not anything I'd ever seen in the Pacific Northwest before. It was very big. And it was staring at me very curiously and just staying right in front of me. And then when it finally decided to leave, it flew very fast. So I looked it up immediately in a bird book and discovered, and this relates to climate change, that it's probably a hummingbird that is not supposed to be up here. It looked like it was the blue-throated hummingbird, based on the flight and the size and the way it looked, and they're not supposed to get much above Texas. So with climate change, you start seeing species moving north as the south dries up. I also saw a Nuttall's woodpecker in a forest where it wasn't supposed to be in eastern Oregon. But the thing that struck me with the hummingbird is I just had this experience with a very unusual animal in a backyard in Portland. But then when you talk about synchronicity, the things that came up to in my mind were examples I have of suddenly seeing an animal I'm not expecting, a rare animal, and then realizing there is a whole pattern of life going on out there, which is this animal's daily life that we're not experiencing at all. I was out with a volunteer with Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project field checking a timber sale in the Ochoco National Forest a few years back. And we were standing there talking about elk. It's broad daylight. We're in a beautiful old growth forest with big logs, big trees, big snags, perfect habitat for Pacific fisher. But that didn't even occur to me because Pacific fisher are not supposed to occur out there anymore. They used to be in almost all forested areas of Oregon. And as we were talking, suddenly I see this huge animal, about 3 feet long, dark brown fur, big claws, running across the top of a big old growth log. And I'm staring at it and I'm so shocked. I just said, that wasn't an elk. And Lumen said, no, let's talk about what we just saw. And she saw the head better than I did, but we both saw it very clearly. It could not have been anything except a Pacific fisher, which is incredibly rare. There's a population known to exist in Southwest Oregon and one further towards the coast, I believe. But as far as I know, there's been no recorded sightings in the Ochoco for quite some time. However, I know what a wolverine looks like. I know what all these other species look like. I've had 25 years in the wild, essentially. And it's the 25th anniversary of Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project this June. And that was just a shock. And suddenly it put everything into a different perspective, like, wow, that animal is living here. And what is its daily life like? What is it doing that I'm not seeing? And I had another similar experience in a more foreign environment to me, which was in Tanzania, where I went out in this big fishing boat, well, old-fashioned fishing boat, wooden, with sails, to go snorkeling. And on the way back, myself and a few other people on the boat happened to be looking in the right direction when out of the deep ocean rose an enormous sea turtle, and it just rose above the crest of the waves and then sank back down again. And we're going, oh! And then you have to realize that there's this whole other life under the ocean where patterns of life go on that we have no clue. And those are important patterns to preserve.
So, well, we have a caller already. I was going to sort of go off on a related tangent. Let's just take the call right now. Johnny, you're on the air.
Hi. Greetings from the great Earth Mother. And so I have a comment, a suggestion, and just a short story, just a really quick, brief short story. First, I just want to share this really quick story that my mother commonly tells. She was sitting in the park in Ashland. I had the name of the park.
That's okay.
Everybody knows this famous park in Ashland. But they were kind of up in the back part of the park, and they were just sitting there, and she saw this red-tail hawk swoop in, and the hawk was about, I don't know, she said about 20 to 50 yards away, and they were kind of sitting up on this slope, and the hawk was down lower, and they were, my mom and her partner were, had just bought like a roasted chicken from the store, and they were just sitting down to eat when this hawk swooped in and sat across the field from them. Well, my mom is just, she's really in tune and just an amazing woman and always has been and always will be. She ripped off a leg and thigh of this chicken and waved it around up in the air. And this hawk took off from its place and my mom threw it up in the air and it the hawk came towards it and the piece of chicken landed on the ground and this hawk pounded on the piece of chicken and then picked it up and carried it off. I thought that was just the most amazing thing. Second of all, the recommendation I would like to recommend to listeners out there, if they are interested in hearing a fascinating story, Clan of the Cave Bear, the book series is just an amazing introduction to the way humanity evolved with animals. And second of all, I would like to hear you elaborate on, in biology, a couple of years ago, my biology teacher said that with the climate change, incurring the climate change, we could very well see Oregon becoming like a tropical forest, like a tropical rainforest instead of just a moderate rainforest. And I would like to take my those thoughts off the air. If you could just elaborate on how much more rain we're getting and how much more heat we're getting, and the encounter of more different diverse types of life that may be coming in, or if that is possible or not.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Johnny. Appreciate your call.
Thank you.
And for all other people who might want to call in, the number is 503-231-8187. Karen?
Yeah. On the question of this area becoming tropical, I don't know. I mean, it's anybody's guess. I would like to try to slow climate change down and try to preserve diversity where it already exists. And there's a lot we need to do that, such as keeping fossil fuels in the ground. There's a very active movement focused just on that, which I encourage people to participate in. I don't really want to speculate on what it might change to, but I'd like to try to preserve the diversity we already have. Provide protective corridors and refugia, try to keep forest canopy cover on the ground, and so forth. In relation to your hawk story, I just want to relate my own hawk story, which is one time I was out, again, field surveying a timber sale in the Malheur National Forest, and I noticed a big hawk in a tree, and I thought it was probably a goshawk. And goshawk get some protective management. They're a management indicator species for the needs of other species that need dense forest, which is the Forest Service is really after dense forest with their logging. And as I got closer, looking at it to try to figure out if it was indeed a goshawk, it started crying. It was, and I realized after a bit, a bigger hawk swooped in, which turned out to be the female. It was the male crying for the female to come because I was too close to the nest. And I looked around to try to figure out where the nest was so that I could back off safely. But I was a little late, and the female came to a perch and hunched up, and it was enormous. I was in awe of this female, and suddenly it started dive bombing me, which they do to scare people off their nests. So here's this huge hawk coming at me with its talons extended, its beak in front. And I knew that I needed to protect myself, so I put the clipboard of my survey sheet over my head and I ducked as low as I could. But I couldn't resist. At the last minute, I raised the clipboard a little bit, and I just had to see this hawk coming at me. And it was one of the most magnificent things I've ever seen, this pure power with a very intent gaze and the talons reaching out and the wings hunched back, coming straight at me. And I shouldn't have disturbed it that much, but the problem was when I tried to back out, I was inadvertently backing towards the nest, and so it did dive bomb me. And then I got out of there as fast as I could, because if there's too much human disturbance, they'll abandon their nest. But that was an amazing experience.
You know, one thing, an author that I've really gotten a lot out of over the years who talks a lot about this sort of thing is Paul Shepard. And he just has this really beautiful, sensitive discussion of our deep, deep, ancient, long coexistence with other animals. I say other animals just to remind ourselves that, yes, we are animals. The deep connection with bears from ancient days, you know, the Clan of the Cave Bear. I personally haven't read that series, and I've always been a little standoffish about it, because it's, you know, it's a historical fiction, is sort of this attempt to imaginatively reconstruct a lost world. But I'm sure there's a lot in there that's very valuable. I just, a cautionary note, I mean, I do think it, in a lot of senses, it really is a lost world. I think we have to be very careful about, you know, how we think about, you know, quote, pre-civilized or pre-modern or pre-historic or whatever, you know, people who lived a very different way of life. But that's just sort of a cautionary note. But he also talks very eloquently about how we're, you know, fundamentally, psychophysically, we are still the same beings that we were, you know, 5,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago. There are, of course, changes that are happening due to the pressures of urbanization and stuff, which is very complex. But you know, we have access to the same basic repertoire of whatever it is that enables us to, you know, to be, you know, animals on this planet, and to have, as I said, as we've been talking about, these kind of experiences, which are, you know, are being suppressed by the spread of a humanized environment, which is really the subject we really want to get into here. And the, you know, the continuing attempts to stave off, you know, the worst impacts of this industrial civilization, whether it's industrial forestry, which we're going to be talking about out in the eastern east side forests. So there's so much to talk about. I just want to, before I forget, just sort of mention this article I came across that I think is worth checking out, called Animism in the Sciences, Then and Now. Because, you know, what label do you give to, like, the kind of experiences we're talking about? Do they need labels? Not really. But as a way to sort of, you know, just to give it a sort of a shape or a form or something, in order to differentiate it from whatever else it is that we're differentiating it from. Animism, I've always thought, is sort of described the way I look at the world. But then this article really kind of kept me back, because the term animism apparently actually was coined by a chemist and physician, George Ernst Stahl, for describing the specificity of living matter, its distinctive character vis-a-vis non-living things. Its modern, almost inverted meaning, however, goes back to the anthropologist Edward Burnett Taylor, who used it to characterize a worldview that does not discriminate, or at least not properly, between living and non-living matter, but believes in universal animation of nature. As his concept of animism is a deviant worldview, as a deviant worldview points to an irrevocable and perhaps irrecoverable separation of the spiritual from the material. So there's just so much in right there that would be several programs in itself. But so you kind of got again, you know, this sort of modern sensibility worldview, scientistic worldview, sort of imposing sort of this definition on whatever it came before. But at the same time, it is actually referring to something. And so anthropology has sort of tried to fill in the gaps and actually, you know, people who've actually lived with, you know, done field work, actually lived with so-called primitive people, non-Western, non-modern peoples, and have had the kinds of experiences that we're talking about that lead us to call it by this name, Animus. Anyway, there's just too much to unpack, so I'll just recommend this article. Maybe we can talk about it in the future. And it's 8:30. We've already gone halfway through. My name's Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio, and I'm speaking with Karen Coulter, longtime activist, advocate for the wild ecosystems, primarily, as she said, for the last 25 years out in eastern Oregon. We'll be talking more specifically about that. But I do want to mention this benefit concert for Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project, which is coming up this Friday. And maybe I can get our engineer Ross to cue up that next cut, which we'll be playing here momentarily. Cinderwell, Brenna Sahatchian, who we heard at the beginning, and Mistaken for Ghosts, their debut show at Velo Cult, which is 1969 Northeast 42nd Avenue here in Portland at 7 p.m. Let's just go to a snippet of the next cut, which is by Brenna Sahatchian and another group. Let's go to that right now.
Spirit and mind bent out of shape from years in a system built to make us break. But I feel strong, I feel strong. No, it seems like our enemies always win, but they ain't got nothing worth envying, 'cause they're still wrong, they're still wrong. They gotta be like a fighting chance. It's what we got when we're clear about for what we stand, and we just push on, we just push on. And spring breeze, blooming of trees, and in my gut, reminding me to what I owe.
That was Brenna Sahatchian with a Tin Tree Factory. She's going to be playing by herself, I believe. And it gives you a taste. And speaking of synchronicity, boy, that song just spoke to pretty much all the themes we're talking about here. I had only just heard the first few seconds of that. I just have a few announcements. I try to do this every week, try to honor all the groups that are out there, or just a few that I come across that are doing good work. So BARC is one of those. They from 6 to 8 p.m., they're talking about the danger of designer trees, genetically engineered trees. Come learn about the growing research that outlines the dangers genetically modified trees pose to biodiversity and species strength across all forests and how you can get involved. 2015 was a busy year in the fight against the commercial release of genetically engineered trees, from coordinating resistance on six continents against the commercial release of GE trees in Brazil, presenting in venues across the Pacific Northwest, training activists in the Southeast, and so much more. We worked hard to stop the menace of GE trees. This is a free screening of Synthetic Forests, The Dangers of Genetically Engineered Trees, produced by Rain Dancer Media and Earthlinks Incorporated. That's today, March 23rd, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the BARC office, 361 Northeast 18th Avenue. And that's Mark with Northwest Range. Speaking of the old days, we used to work together with the Cascadia Forest Alliance. It's just all coming together here in the end days. So that's tonight, 6 to 8 p.m. Next Tuesday, I'm just going to present these in the, well, let me do them in order. Tomorrow from 7 to 9 p.m. at Mother Foucault's Bookshop, 523 Southeast Morrison Street. Join Marilyn Buck Abolitionist Collective for a night of inspirational reading and discussion. Selected work from Marilyn Buck will be read by members of MBAC, followed by a Q&A and discussion. What we have in Marilyn Buck is a poet who is unafraid to confront the deepest parts of herself with and honestly consistent with the consciousness of a revolutionary. That's Jack Hirschman. And that's, again, at Mother Foucault's, 523 Southeast Morrison, from 7 to 9 p.m. tomorrow, Thursday. Saturday, from 4 to 6 p.m., join the Portland Committee for Human Rights in the Philippines, an organization composed of Filipino and Filipino-American immigrant youth students, professionals, workers, and allies working together in solidarity to advance the National Democratic Movement of the Philippines. That's an afternoon of solidarity and building with our allied organizations and individuals who are working for peace and justice in the Portland area. Hope to have a sharing of food and politics, an effort to highlight our linked struggles and liberations. That's 4 to 6 p.m. at Reedwood Friends, 2901 Southeast Steel in Portland, 4 to 6 p.m. Saturday. Next Tuesday, March 29th, 7 to 9 p.m. at Multnomah Friends Meeting House, 4312 Southeast Stark. Join us for an info session to learn more about the Thin Green Line resisting Northwest fuel exports and plans to break free from fossil fuels. What's Break Free? A global climate movement initiative to shut down the world's most dangerous fossil fuel projects and support the most ambitious climate solutions. In mid-May, climate justice activists across the Pacific Northwest will gather in Anacortes, Washington for 3 days of creative demonstrations and direct action at the Shell and Tesoro refineries on March Point. For more information, breakfreepnw.org in connection to connect with Portland organizing, 350pdx.org. That's next Tuesday, March 29th, 7 to 9 p.m. So much going on as always. That's just a little bit of it. I know there's much more. Please let me know what's going on in your neck of the woods at paulrkboo@gmail.com. We're running out of time here rapidly. Let's go to our next caller. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to share an experience I had in Eastern Oregon with an animal. I was out there backpacking for about a week, and one day there was a deer in our camp, and it let us come pretty close to it. And I think that animals in Eastern Oregon are a lot more accepting of human contact, and it's pretty nice to be able to get close to nature out there. But yeah, I think that biodiversity is great.
Thank you.
Okay. And so, Karen, before we get to Norm, hang on just another second. I know, you know, this time flies so fast. So talk a little bit about, you know, there's some really major stuff happening in plan for the future of your beloved forests on the east side. We need to get that in so we make sure we talk about that. Although, you know, we want to encourage people to come on Friday and they can hear even more about it at the Velo Cult at 7 p.m. So what's going on out on the east side?
Well, on top of a huge timber sale program that's already happening and a lot of herbicide use as well, as well as ongoing livestock grazing, which can be especially detrimental to streams and fish, there is now a plan for greatly accelerated scale and pace of logging that the Region 6 of the Forest Service is pushing, which would entail 610,000 acres of logging and burning over three national forests with only one draft, one environmental impact statement, and over the timeline of a single small timber sale. In other words, this is all to be implemented over only 10 years. And this is an enormous scale of logging to do that fast. It would be an incredible shock to the species in that ecosystem, because it looks like they're planning to just clear forest density pretty indiscriminately across every type of forest they encounter within those areas. And this is a major part of these forests. In the case of the Ochoco, it looks like almost half the forest. In the case of the Umatilla and the Wallowa Whitman, the other two forests, it looks like up to a third of the forest that is not already protected with roadless areas, research natural areas, or wilderness areas. So this is a huge timber grab, and they're even planning to do forest plan amendments to allow them to violate the existing forest plan standards and go ahead and log large trees they're not supposed to be logging, to log an old growth forest, to log critical elk and deer hiding in thermal cover, which helps them give them protection and security from predators, including hunters. And also, they're even talking about affecting road density. There's road density standards to try to keep the roads down to a level where there is enough security wildlife habitat for animals that are susceptible to human disturbance. So this is an extreme plan. We're putting an action alert out about it. And if anybody wants to be on our action alert list, we do email. We can also send it to a physical address. Check out our website and look at the action alerts there, which this will be on our website. And it's our website is Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project, all spelled out, bluemountainsbiodiversityproject.wordpress.org. And that will also give you information about the benefit this Friday and upcoming timber sales we're working on, and views of what we're seeing out there and testimony from our volunteers. We have a volunteer internship program where people come out and physically help us field survey thousands of acres of proposed timber sales every summer, and otherwise we couldn't cover the ground. And that's what makes us more credible to the public, the courts, and the Forest Service, our ability to actually see what's going on in their proposed timber sale units.
So people can actually have some of these amazing, wonderful encounters with animals and do good work at the same time.
Exactly. And that's part of the attraction of it. It's a very popular program. We teach volunteers forest ecology, wildlife and plant identification, map and compass orienteering, and much more. And in return, they fill out survey sheets. We train you. You don't have to know anything when you come in. We teach you how to measure things correctly. And we gather needed information that we use in our comments, our appeals or objections, and possible litigation on these timber sales. So people are enjoying the hike and seeing lots of wildlife, which you can see more readily on the east side because the forest is more open, and learning a lot and providing us with useful information at the same time. And if you come to the benefit this Friday, you'll see photo displays of photographs that volunteers and I took in the forest in these different timber sales.
You know, it's like every one of these programs is like four programs crammed into one. You know, we could talk about the occupation of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge, which is not that far from, you know, where you're involved. And are you involved with the Malheur National Forest as
well? Oh, yes. We field survey the National Forest. And suffice it to say, we have to be very vigilant against all the threats to privatize public lands. I don't want to talk about the Bundy case extensively. I think they've gotten far too much attention. However, I do want to point out that the community of Burns was not very welcoming of the Bundys. They weren't representing the people of Eastern Oregon in general. They were coming in, unfortunately, from my home state. I don't think they represented everybody from Nevada. I was born in Oregon, but I grew up in Nevada. And yeah, there's a big radical extreme right fringe getting a lot more attention than it deserves, because it's actually not the majority of the people in this country.
So with that, we could talk about that for an entire program. But Norm has been so patiently waiting. Norm, you're on the air now.
Yeah, hi, thanks. I like your show, Paul.
Go ahead.
Karen, you were talking about seeing a fissure.
Mm-hmm.
I saw something. It was kind of like dark brown, about 2.5 feet long, mostly tail, and it was going after a squirrel. But is that a marten? Is that a fisher? I'm not sure about the difference.
Okay, I can explain the difference. If it was very dark brown, and it was 2.5 to 3 feet long, it would have been a fissure. Martens are only about 1.5 to the most, 1 to 1.5 feet long, really, and they're light brown. Martens are skinny, like weasels. They're like a big weasel, and they have a very cute face with dark points, but they're mostly light brown. And they move very fast. A typical marten sighting is a blur. They tend to be, martens tend to be active around dusk and dawn, usually around higher elevation, moisture mixed conifer like spruce fir forest, but they can extend down further. Fissures, on the other hand, are about 3 feet long, and they have very conspicuous bushy tails. Martens' tails are smaller, and they're much darker brown, and you can actually see the claws, at least I did. And they're dark brown consistently across their whole body. And fissures are known for running along the top of old growth logs. Both species need old growth snags. The marten actually is small enough to fit in pileated woodpecker nest holes. The pileated is a very large woodpecker, and they actually den in pileated nest holes to raise their kits. Fissures need bigger hollow trees because they're a bigger species.
Well,
and the fissures also tend to hang out around lakes in the Cascades.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, that sounded like a very exhaustive. So let's just go to our next caller. Mike, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Thanks good morning. For the show. Yeah, I have a question. Is the lake in the basin of Eastern Oregon, is that drying up? What's the turkey vulture population going up or down, and what is it about Forest Service policy that is changing to allow this change in the grab? Thank you very much.
I don't know which lake in the basin you're talking about, but if you're talking about Alvord Lake, it may very well be drying up. It's a desert lake. The turkey vulture population, I haven't seen any great diminishment in that. I think they're doing okay as far as I can tell. Unfortunately, for most of our wildlife species in Eastern Oregon, nobody's doing population studies. So we have no idea what their population status is, their reproductive success, or their viability thresholds. I'm not particularly concerned about turkey vultures, though. As for the Forest Service policy, it just seems to be a big grab. It just seems like they've gone berserk, and it's profit motive over everything else. And some of them are kind of brainwashed, it seems, by an early take on the science for dry forest, which they're now extrapolating to moisture mixed conifer forest. And now there's much more scientific controversy about whether historically the dry ponderosa pine dominant forest really was as open as was earlier thought, because the Forest Service is basically going after forest density wherever it exists. And that's a big impact to species that are adapted and evolved with denser forests, like goshawks, like marten, like a number of them, like Pacific fisher, pileated woodpecker, black-backed woodpecker. And so I'm afraid we're going to lose a lot of these management indicator species and rarer species through this grab for forest density across the landscape, which is not looking at the variability that exists in those forests where it naturally is denser.
And of course, the whole issue of fire, we spoke about this a couple times with people from BARC, because that's the excuse that's used for some timber sales proposed up on Mount Hood and all over the place. And it seems to be that's the excuse, the current excuse, along with insects and other things. But one tidbit that really stuck with me, which is that it's a crapshoot that, like, they said something like 17% or something of fires actually start. Oh God, I'm going to totally blow this. That the correlation between, like, actually the timber sales that are done to actually stop fires, that the actual number of fires that it actually prevents is really, really low. It's really a crapshoot. They start fairly randomly. They can start where there was a timber sale, where there wasn't. It's like it seems to be completely unrelated.
Yeah, I'd like to address that now that you've raised fire. Ever since the Bush administration in particular, they started doing this propaganda for the public to excuse accelerated scale and pace of logging. It's calling logging restoration and logging fire risk reduction. First of all, logging isn't restoration because it's supposed to be building resiliency, according to the Forest Service public relations. However, logging poses its own unnatural impacts to the ecosystem, and restoration is supposed to do no harm first. Secondly, on fire, there is no evidence that the fire risk reduction, as they call it, logging they're doing now, will actually reduce the incidence or severity of fire, especially under climate change. I mean, look at the fires we had across eastern Oregon in 2015. Basically, wherever there was an ignition, the fires took off because it was a drought year and because there were high wind speeds. And it's really the weather and the climate that drive the severity and the extent of the fires. And it's usually rain or a change in climate weather patterns that puts it out, not the fuel loading. What they're trying to do reduce is the biomass, which is needed for carbon sequestration and nutrient cycling for the forest ecosystem, but they're calling it fuel, and they're trying to reduce that, thinking that that will reduce the fire. But these fires burned across everything, private lands everywhere. It didn't matter how it was logged. So only when you have less severe weather will you have any impact from reducing fuel loading. And the most sensible place to do that, to try to reduce risk to homes and communities, is immediately around the houses and the communities rather than way out in the backcountry. That logging way out in the backcountry is not likely to have much effect in protecting homes or communities.
So we have 10 minutes left, and actually less, at 9 in a few minutes on Political Perspectives. Host Kristen Yount asks, what do you know about the Willamette Harbor Superfund site? And once again, we would like to thank KBOO members for your support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And I have had Karen Coulter with me in the studio this morning. Once again, it's been wonderful. Time flies. And Karen works with a Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project, and they are having a benefit concert at the Velo Colt at 1969 Northeast 42nd Avenue this Friday, March 25th at 7 p.m. with Cinderwell, Dark Folk, Brenna Sahatchian, who you heard a couple samples of her work, Layered Alternative Folk, and Mistaken for Ghosts, their debut show. So find out all about them. So that should be wonderful. Meet fellow attuned souls to all these issues, get some updates on what's going on, some visual presentations, and I believe also a raffle.
And a silent auction as well, and a slideshow about what we're doing in the Blue Mountains.
So that's all this Friday. Gordon has also been patiently waiting. Are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah.
Yes, so a couple quick points. I guess what I want to say is, isn't a lot of this logging and the pushing and of it and the expedience of it is really the foundation of it comes from the WTO. Basically, the WTO says you have resources. It doesn't matter about your environmental laws. It doesn't matter about what you have in stock. You have resources. You must cut it down and sell it. I think that's what the WTO does. And lastly, I think what we're dealing with is the Forestry Service I've always had an admiration for, but over the 20 years that I've grown to be a man, knowing that this might be one of the most corrupt and highly contradicting and hypocritical organizations in the federal government, because the foxes are in the hen house. You have the timber industry running the forestry department, just like you have Monsanto running the food industry. So let's hear what you have to say about those two things.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with the World Trade Organization. I was part of the protest in Seattle, and I used to be and still am part of a group called Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy. And we have a book which will be on sale at the benefit called The Elite Consensus, which basically is a citizen's guide to all these institutions that leverage corporate power. And you're right for pointing that out as a big influence in what's happening globally. I think it's the general influence of capitalism which is driving the Forest Service policy in general, because these sales don't even make sense. They're not producing much money. The trees are pretty small. They're on too fast of a rotation. They're coming back to cut too soon before the trees have reached maximum size. Capitalism is basically the exploitation of nature and people's labor. It's a system that we need to get away from. It's not working, obviously. It's gone to the point of international corporate power, to the point where it's not even in the best interests of the individual country. It's not even in the best interests of the people in the country. The public services are getting cut, ecological protections getting cut, and so forth. So you're totally right to bring up that in a bigger vein.
And to tie the two things that he brought up together, it's the politicians who are captured by this economic system, who are in a position of decision-making power and have power of the purse strings, including the Department of Agriculture, where the Forest Service resides, they have upped the appropriations for the timber sale. They've upped the level of mandated cut, right? I believe in the last appropriations, which is partly what's driving some of this. That's what the people from BARC told me. I was given to understand that there's. So, you know, that goes back to the, you know, 25 years ago when we're fighting these battles, 30 years ago, trying to actually rein in the Forest Service, because the timber sale program was just out of control and totally run by the timberist industry. And the timber industry is driven by this reckless expansionist economic system, and which, you know, chews everything up and throws it away in a nutshell. So that's what's going on as well. So, you know, you can also get in contact with your congresspeople, raise hue and cry about the appropriations to the, you know, the skewed appropriations within the timber sale program, the Forest Service, and come to the benefit on Friday. And what else? What are the other, there's a BARC is the one of the local groups that's working on Mount Hood. So what other groups are working out there in Eastern Oregon?
There's not many in Eastern Oregon. I suggest that people come out and volunteer with us. I suggest that they contribute to local grassroots groups that are fighting on issues they care about rather than the bigger mainstream groups, which tend to have more money. I think it's just really important to show public opposition. For instance, we have an action alert list. So does BARC. We need to show more public opposition. We need to build back a direct action movement to actually protest these things. And that's very vibrant right now on fossil fuels and climate change, as it should be. But we also need to rebuild the forest defense movement. And I want to just, getting back to our animism theme for just a second, I want to quote Rosalie Little Thunder, who is an elder who is very instrumental to protection of the bison in Montana with the Buffalo Field Campaign. Unfortunately, she passed recently. And I just want to quote her about what we're losing. She says, "We want to be related to the buffalo because they're smart. Little trees learn to be smart from old trees, right? The rocks are really smart, too. The wind must be too. Water. Us." So the point there is people used to have a much deeper connection to all their relations, all the different species, the rocks, the water, the trees, everything. And we need to regain that.
And that's, we need to create spaces for doing that. So you hold space. Out in what town are you near? Based out of there?
I'm near the town of Fossil. I'm on the slope of a mountain out there.
So that's Karen Coulter, where she's at. She's holding space out there, creating opportunities for people to reconnect. BARC has a lot of hikes and stuff, and has an office here in Portland. And Other places like the Anaris Info Shop up in North Portland are holding space, creating a social space for people to get together, and many others. If you are one of those, get in touch with me, paulrkboo@gmail.com. Thank you so much, Karen. We got to get out of here.
Thank you. And these groups need funding, too, so please donate.
So, benefit concert this Friday at VeloCult with Cinderwell, Brenna Sahatchian, Mistaken for Ghosts, 7 p.m. out in the Hollywood District, VeloCult. We're going to go out with a little more Brenna Sahatchian. This has been Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Thank you so much, and thank you, Ross, our wonderful engineer.
Thank you.
An echo of your own. It is to work and have such pay. It just needs life from day to day. In your limbs as in a cell. For the tyrants used to dwell. And to be for him made. Loom and plow and sword and spade. With or without your own will bent. To their defense and nourishment.
And good morning. It is just a few seconds before 9 a.m. here on KBOO Portland. KBOO has offered a Bill of the Month membership since the very beginning of the station. Now you can be a sustaining member without any of the paperwork. We here at KBOO Community Radio encourage everyone who donates to become a monthly donor. Our members that give us monthly provide the most secure and stable funding for the station. It's easy and secure. You can set up your monthly donation through your checking account. We can also set up your membership with a debit or credit card. Monthly giving helps us cut down on the number of membership drive days we air annually. Also, monthly members are automatically entered into all of our sweepstakes drawings. So go to kboo.fm/give today to become a sustaining member online or call us at 503-231-8032. And thank you.